Okay, so good morning, everybody. How are you all today? Very well. So we come here today to practice some meditation, share some Dhamma together, and hopefully get enlightened. We can do our very best anyway. It would be nice because tomorrow you have to go back to work, don't you? So it'd be good if you could be enlightened before you go back to work, then makes it much easier. So for today's program, we're going to be learning some metta meditation. But before we get on to doing the metta meditation, I want to offer a few remarks about meditation in general. So when we come to practice meditation, we bring our own set of assumptions to that. Even though we think that meditation is beyond words, beyond ideas, beyond concepts. This is where we're headed with our meditation. But still, when we practice meditation, the way that we talk about the meditation, the way that we think about it, very strongly shapes how we use our minds, how we pay attention. And by shaping how we pay attention, it shapes what the results of the meditation are. So it's important to be very careful in how we choose our words, and it's important to reflect from time to time on how our choice of words, our choice of language, influences the way that we go about meditation. And in fact, in this regard, as in so many others, I believe that the Buddha was one of the great innovators. If we look in ancient India, the time before the Buddha, yes, there was meditation and there are teachings about meditation and so on, but we don't find anything that's really clear and explicit talking about meditation. And the Buddha was, I think, the first person to ever be able to really understand what was going on at a psychological level in these different states of meditation and to describe it in a very, very clear way. So for this morning's talk and for this morning's practice, I'm going to talk about, I'm going to use breath meditation. We're going to be talking in the context of breath meditation or anapanasati. And so I want you to do that practice for this morning, and then this afternoon we'll look at doing the metta practice. Okay, so when we come to do breath meditation, perhaps the most common of all the Buddhist meditations, in many ways the most powerful, the meditation that the Buddha himself said that he practiced even after he was enlightened, when the Buddha went on retreat, and he said to the monks, if anybody asks me what I'm doing while I'm on retreat, he said, I'm watching my breath go in and out. So even though this is a practice which we often begin with, we shouldn't think that it's something which is basic or just introductory. It's a very profound practice. And the way that we go about this practice, the assumptions that we bring to it, will condition the results we're going to get from that practice. Now, one of the things about Buddhism, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but sometimes the marketing and the reality don't add up. Have you ever noticed that? And people say, oh, you meditate and you'll be peaceful and happy. And then you go and you meditate and, oh, it's so distracted and I feel so tense and so much suffering. They didn't tell me about this. How come I'm supposed to be peaceful when I'm meditating and I'm anything but peaceful? In fact, I feel a lot less peaceful now than I did beforehand. It's a bit of a worry, isn't it? So what's going on? Why is it that sometimes when we come to practice peacefulness, you end up feeling very tense? Some people have what they call samadhi headache. Have you ever had samadhi headache? Anyone here? Surely meditation should make your headaches go away, not make them come. So one of the problems that we have is that when we come to meditation, we always, and this is a very natural thing to do, but we always bring to the meditation practice the assumptions and the patterns of thinking that we have in the rest of our lives. Right? And so you think about how we do that. So if we want to, for example, if you're at work or in education or something like that, and you want to, you have a certain goal in mind, and then so you say, okay, there's a goal, and I have to do this, 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 this in order to achieve that goal, and you say, well, what do I need to do those things? And you get the material and time and whatever you need to do that, and you do all those things one after the other, and then you achieve your goal, or not. And so when we come to Buddhist practice, we often think in the same kind of way, don't we? We think, oh, well, this is my goal, I want to be enlightened, but not just yet, okay? Eventually. One of the founders of the Catholic Church, I can't remember which one it was now, his most famous saying was, oh God, make me pure, but not just yet. So we all want to get enlightened, but we're not quite sure if we're ready for it. Anyway, let's just leave that aside for now. Let's take a more immediate goal. We want to have peace of mind. I think everybody can agree. We want to be peaceful. We want to be happy. Okay, so that's at least on the path to Nibbana. If it's not quite Nibbana yet, but at least it's on the way there. So that's good. So we have this goal, and then we think, okay, well, how do I get this goal? And then you think, well, I do these practices, and I do that retreat, and I do this kind of meditation, and you kind of shop around and find what the most effective meditation is, and you kind of do that one. And so we take that same kind of attitude towards things. But of course, the problem ultimately is that spiritual life is completely different. And spiritual life is not about getting what you want. Spiritual life is about giving up things. It's about letting go. And so even though, sometimes we can't help talk in that kind of language, about gaining something or getting samadhi or gaining peace of mind, or we talk about progressing and moving forward and achieving goals and things. Sometimes you use that kind of language, but actually it's not a very helpful language to use when talking about meditation. So the real language of meditation is always the language of letting go. The Buddha said in the Indriya Samyutta, Vosagara manang karitva labhati samadhi labhati citta se kagatam. based on letting go, that one gains samadhi and unification of mind. Based on letting go. So what happens is that we bring these kind of worldly patterns and behaviors and ways of thought into our meditation, we apply them, and then sometimes they don't work in quite the way that we think they should, because spiritual practice is much more subtle, and it's hard to pin it down. And so then, of course, we blame the path, or we blame the teacher, or something like that, or we blame ourselves. I'm hopeless, I can't do it, this meditation's no good. So this attitude of mind is what they use the word spiritual materialism to describe this. And I think spiritual materialism is a wonderful phrase. On a basic level, spiritual materialism means, you know, literally we invest material things with spiritual qualities, right? So things like Buddha images and stupas and things like that. But on a deeper level, what it means is that we bring the same attitudes of achieving and getting and so on into our spiritual life. And when we understand this and we look, you know, take the opportunity to look and reflect on the patterns of mind, the patterns of thought that go around that, then you begin to realize how counterproductive this is. And one of the reasons why we do this is because in our hearts, we're very afraid of letting go. Isn't that right? People are afraid of, aren't we afraid of letting go? And people tell me so often, letting go is hard. Letting go is not hard. Letting go is the easiest thing in the world. Letting go is really, really easy. People ask me, how should I start practicing? If I want to start practicing letting go, what should I do? I say, it's very easy. You just ring up your work and you quit. You give away your home. Say goodbye to your family. And walk down the street with nothing. What could be simpler? It takes you 5 minutes. 5 minutes. A couple of phone calls. A few goodbyes. That's it. You're out. But why don't we do that? Well, there are many reasons. Sometimes we have good reasons to not do those things. I'm not trying to suggest that you all do that, right? I'm not getting in big trouble, okay, if I say that. But I'm just trying to point out, well, what's the idea here? What's actually stopping you from doing that, right? There's nothing stopping you from doing that, really. The only thing is sometimes we have is our fears. What's going to happen? So one of the purposes of meditation is like a laboratory or an incubator for letting go, right? It's where we can experiment with letting go within limits, within boundaries, right? And this is one of the reasons why it's very important to have formal meditation practice. And sometimes people say, oh, you don't need to do formal meditation, you can just be mindful in everything that you do, which is probably okay for people who actually can be mindful in everything that they do. Is there anybody here who's tried and succeeded at being mindful for one whole day while going about their work and their activities? No, I don't think so. It's hard enough, even if you're on retreat, it's hard enough to practice being mindful, yeah? Much less if you're being distracted by everything. So we have the period of formal meditation. Now, not only does that give us a chance to focus completely on what we're doing, but it also, very importantly, it gives us the permission to allow anything to happen. Okay? And this is very, very important in your meditation. You know, give yourself the permission, anything can happen and it's okay. And we had at our workshop we had here yesterday, I mentioned something about this, and some of the people came during the interviews and said that the things that I've been talking about have been actually happening to them. So they're very relieved to know it's okay. Yeah? And sometimes maybe you'll just cry. And you just sit there and cry and cry and cry. It's okay. Yeah, it's all right. You can sit there for the whole meditation and cry. It's all right. Actually, every good meditation retreat needs a crier. Okay? So if you're sitting there crying away, then you're filling an essential role on the retreat. And you're a bodhisattva for everybody else. Okay? So don't feel embarrassed. Yeah? You're, by sitting there and crying, you are showing everybody else that it's okay. Yeah? So if they need to have a good cry too, then they can do it. That's okay. But you can't do that when you're having a meeting at your work, can you? You can't say, excuse me, I just want to have a bit of a cry and we can continue the meeting afterwards. Right? And sometimes when you're meditating, you get like a fit of the giggles. You'd just be laughing. You'd be sitting there with a big grin on your face and laughing away to yourself, right? But again, you can't do that when you're at work, can you? People will think you're a bit nutty. So when you're operating and functioning in the world, you have to be able to control and manage your emotions to some degree, right? And you have to be able to operate and to function. When you're in meditation, you don't have to function. You don't have to be competent, right? You don't have to be anything at all, right? Remember the beautiful words told by Soma Bhikkhuni to Mara when Mara came along to attack her in a meditation, and he said to her, "How can you achieve these states that are hard to achieve even by the great sages? You're just a woman, right? How can you achieve these things? Women only have two-fingered wisdom," is the phrase that he uses, right? So always remember this, that if anybody's saying that wisdom are less that women are less intelligent or anything like that, that's Maraism, not Buddhism, yeah? And he said women have two-fingered wisdom, and I don't know quite, it's a bit unclear exactly what that idiom, two-fingered wisdom, means, but what I think it means is that you kind of pick things up like that. You can't really grasp things. So, you know, this is a two-fingered wisdom. You sort of, whereas if you've got real wisdom, you can grasp it properly, like a man. So this is what Mara said to Soma, the Bhikkhuni. And her response was classic. Yeah, she said, "Mara, what use do I have for these concepts of being a man or a woman? While I'm sitting here in meditation, my mind is purified, I see the Dhamma." She said, "Anybody who thinks in terms of I am a man or I am a woman or I am anything at all, yeah, then Mara, you go off and talk to them. Leave me alone." Yeah? What a fantastic response, right? What would you do if Mara came to you in your meditation? You'd be like, oh please God, leave me alone. Okay, so anyone who thinks I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm anything at all. So we leave all of those things behind when we come to meditate. You're not old, you're not young, you're not a man, you're not a woman, you're not Sri Lankan, you're not Australian, you're not anything else. Right? You're not a Buddhist or a Christian, you're not anything. We forget all of those things. Is only the mind, only our awareness. So what do we do with that awareness? So if our meditation is all about letting go, and we have that safe space within which to let go, we have to have the courage to be able to do that. This kitty is not ready to let go yet. She has a little kitten up there, so she has to look after her. So if we're coming to meditation, we're wanting to let go. What's the first thing we do? Well, the first thing we do, and I've noticed this in meditation circles for many, many years, and I've looked at this and found it very puzzling. The first thing we do when we meditate is we get really, really attached to our meditation method. Have you noticed that? It's kind of weird, isn't it? Yeah. Here we are to let go of everything, and suddenly we're like, oh, this is the only way. This is the best meditation. This is the right way. That one's the wrong way. You have to do this method. This is the way to enlightenment. You know, there was an excellent book done, written in the 1970s called The Zen Monastic Experience by a fellow, I think his name is Robert Buswell, and he ordained in Korea, in Korean Zen circles. Before he ordained as a Korean Zen monk, he travelled quite widely around the Buddhist world and went to see many different meditation masters. And in the foreword to a book, the introduction, the whole book is actually very interesting, but in the introduction to the book, he says that he went to all of these different meditation masters and they all told him how to get enlightened. Right? And then he went to one teacher, was Ajahn Mahabua in the Thai forest tradition. And he asked for teachings from Ajahn Mahabua. And Ajahn Mahabua said to him, I can't really tell you how to get enlightened, but these are some practices that I've done that I found useful for me. And maybe if you'd like, you could try them out and you might find them to be useful as well. Yeah? So to me, that's the Dhamma. Yeah? It's not about being dogmatic, it's not about being right and wrong. It's about, well, what is useful? Okay? Now, you will hear in Buddhist circles these days, you hear lots and lots of different meditation methods and different teachers and different people will say different things and so on. And people often come to me and say, well, what do you think about this teacher or that teacher or this book and that book? I say, I don't know. I haven't read a book about meditation for nearly 20 years. I just meditate. Occasionally I write books about meditation, but I don't really read them very much. And I kind of wonder why people are running around always trying to look for the best teacher or the best method or whatever. A method can't save you. Yeah? Simple as that. This is just, I mean, it would be interesting to see some more studies done on this. It would be something that you could test, you know, but I know there have been studies done in psychology on this, and my friend Enkong Tan said that they, I can't remember the exact figures, but they basically worked out that in psychology, about 70%, 60 or 70% of the effectiveness of doing therapy depends on the patient. About 20 or 30% depends on the therapist, and about 10% depends on the kind of therapy that you're doing, right? So the theory contributes about 10% to the actual healing, right? And I think probably it's similar in meditation, yeah? 60, 70% of what you're doing is about what you bring to the table, yeah? Then if you have a skillful teacher, then they can help you to some degree, but then the details of the method maybe matter a little bit this way or that way. Yeah, I remember again many years ago I was in Bodhinyana, and you know you always have this kind of notion that a lot of people have this idea that you can get some great enlightened psychic power master who can read your mind and know what meditation you practiced in your past lives, and then they can tell you what's going to be exactly the right meditation for you, so you can like really fast. Yeah, and so. They actually asked Ajahn Chah about this one time. A man asked Ajahn Chah, he said, do you teach your students by reading their minds? He said, here at my monastery, we learn to read our own minds. Yeah? And this other time I heard this one monk asked this teacher that. He said, you know, what meditation have I practiced in my past life? Can you teach me so that I can practice much faster, right? And so this was a monk who had this reputation of being able to see people's past lives and so on. Whether he can or not, I don't know, but that's what his reputation was. And he gave a very interesting response to that. You know, he said, look, you know, you can run around looking after these things your whole life, but he said, all of the meditation masters that I know, this is what he said, all the meditation masters that I know all teach and practiced the core meditations of Buddhism, the breath anapanasati, the contemplation of impermanence and vipassana, the contemplation of different parts of the body and metta and so on. And these central meditations, and these are the ones that are really effective and really useful for people. So we shouldn't get too caught up and too hung up in the details of different techniques and so on. And so one of the things that I've found, and I think partly this is to do with the evolving in the meditation culture in the 20th century, we found that, you know, if you think about how you would learn meditation traditionally, you go along to a temple, maybe in your local village or, you know, your local temple, and you grow up there, right? And you go there your whole life, and you'd pick up bits and pieces about meditation here and there, sometimes from some bhānas, some dhamma talks, sometimes from bits of suttas that you might know, sometimes from talking people, and you gradually learn a bit about meditation. Sometimes you might go and ask some questions and so on, and you gradually learn how to meditate as part of that culture. And, you know, when I was in northeast Thailand, you know, you could see that's still how people do that, right? And it's something that's with you for your whole life. You know, it evolves and grows with you as part of how you're growing. Whereas what we do, we have kind of prepackaged meditation techniques, right? It's all kind of laid out for us. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is what you do. And you sort of go, it's like kind of fast food meditation, right? You go along and do the retreats and you get, this is what you do and this is what the results are. And that's the kind of way that it's been packaged in recent times. Again, it's not a matter of saying this is right or wrong. It's a way which is, you know, it works within a certain cultural context. But I'm just asking you to reflect on that and to understand something about the way that these meditation techniques actually work within a community. So when the danger in that approach to meditation is, first of all, that it has kind of one-size-fits-all meditation. And I'm very conscious of this when I'm talking to you in this room today. There's, what, 60, 70 people or something, maybe 100 people in this room. And I'm just saying one thing, right? I just have one bunch of words coming out of this mouth, but there's 100 different sets of words going in those ears, yeah? And I can't control that, unfortunately, or probably fortunately. So you're not all hearing the same thing, right? And very commonly, you can go out of the Dhamma talk and talk to somebody else who heard the same Dhamma talk. What was that about? And you can have completely different ideas about what it was about. You heard different things, you remember different things, you reflected on them, you interpreted them in different ways. There's 100 different Dhamma talks going on right now, okay? And no, I'm not reading all of your minds and shaping all the words to go into there. I'm just doing my best. So this tendency always is that we tend to objectify and we tend to focus on the external forms of things. Whereas the most important thing in meditation is, what do we bring to the meditation? Yeah. Again, this is something that's very much emphasized in the Thai forest tradition. You know, if you go to the different Thai forest meditation masters and you say, you know, I do this kind of meditation or I do that kind of meditation, and so on, then they won't say this one's right and that one's wrong. They won't. They'll say, okay, that's fine. Yeah, you do anapanasati, that's fine. You do, you know, you learn from this trinity, that's fine. But just be mindful. Yeah? They keep on coming back to the subject. What does it feel like in the meditation? What are you bringing to the meditation? Okay? So if we're talking about breath meditation, okay? Every person here is doing breath meditation in a slightly different way. Right? It's not one thing that's breath meditation. And when we talk about the breath, the way that we use language in our modern meditation culture, we tend to talk about meditation objects. We have this whole way of thinking and talking about meditation, which I think is quite misleading and quite damaging, and is not talked about is not how the Buddha talked about it, right? So we talk about meditation objects, and the Buddha never used this word meditation object, okay? And that's important. It's an important difference. Why? Well, what is an object? An object, by definition, is something which exists objectively from you, right? When we talk about, say, scientific truth, we say scientific truth. Why? Because it's objective. That means that if different people look at that same theory or those same findings, they'll come to the same conclusions. That's what we mean by objective. Something exists outside of you, right? But there's no such thing as a meditation object. There's no object that... the breath doesn't exist outside of you, right? The breath, in fact, is intimately connected with all of your thoughts and emotions, and it's changing all of the time. It's the very opposite of what an object is, right? So we say we're watching the breath. The Buddha never said, watch your breath. Yeah? This idiom, I'm going to watch my breath, that's not an idiom we find in Buddhism. So sato va asasati, sato pasasati. Ever mindful, one breathes in. Ever mindful, one breathes out. Yeah? It's not saying I'm watching the breath, the object of my breath. Dighang va asasanto, dighang asasanmiti pajanati. One understands when breathing in a long breath, I'm breathing in a long breath. When breathing out a long breath, I'm breathing out a long breath. When breathing in a short breath, I'm breathing in a short breath. When breathing out a short breath, I'm breathing out a short breath. This is the Buddha's instructions in the Anapanasati Sutta. So there's no breath as an object. There's a breath as a behavior. Right? First person verbs, right? I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. Yeah. The breath is something that you do. It's not something that you have. It's something that you do. So when we're observing our breath, we're observing how we are behaving. We're not observing an object. It's not a static thing. Okay? So, come back to the question I raised at the beginning of the Dhamma talk. Why is it that so often when we come to meditation, we want to be peaceful, we want to be happy, we want to let go, and yet when we're meditating, we're finding the mind gets tighter and tighter and tighter, harder. We have samadhi headache. Sometimes you see people, their brows are furrowed. And when I talk to people about meditation, there's one overriding story that I hear. Almost everybody that I talk to about meditation will tell me the same thing. And I'm going to tell you that story now very briefly, and you can see whether it applies to you. When I sit meditation, I try to concentrate on my breath, but it's really hard because all of these thoughts are distracting me. Does that sound like your meditation? A few people shaking their heads, that's good. I'm glad that doesn't apply to you. But many people, I think that's how you experience meditation. Many people, when they talk to me about meditation, that's how they describe it. And I've begun to notice this more and more and more over the last couple of years. And the more that I look at it, and the more I think about it, the more it seems to me this is a very unhelpful way of talking about meditation. And very unlike the way the Buddha talked about meditation. Okay? So let's unpack this a little bit and see what assumptions are in the language. Okay? I'm trying to concentrate on my breath. Okay? Let's see what's implied there. Well, the first one is the I, right? we'll leave the I. We'll just notice that for the moment. We'll leave that aside. I'm trying. Is that in the Buddha's descriptions of anapanasati? Does the Buddha say try? Right? It says breathing in, one breathes a long breath, breathing out, one breathes a short. It doesn't say you try to do anything, really. It's just saying you're breathing. Do you have to try to breathe? No? So those of you who like myself, were brought up, our first Dhamma lessons were from watching Star Wars when we were kids, would know that Yoda said, do or do not, there is no try. And if you think that it's a coincidence, then you don't know your Star Wars history, because Yoda was actually modeled after the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, okay? So if he sounds like a Zen master, that's because he is a Zen master, all right? Do or do not, there is no try. So why is it that we're trying so hard? What are we trying for? Okay, I'm trying to concentrate, and this word concentrate. We'll ask, what does the word concentrate mean in English? Okay, how do we actually use that mostly in the English language, right? Mostly, how you use concentrate in the English language is if you've got some kids at the back of the class who are messing around and you want them to concentrate on what you're talking about. Shut up and concentrate, right? Stop messing around and concentrate, yeah? And so what does that mean? What it means is that there's something which is inherently boring and you'd rather be doing something else, and you have to make yourself do something that's inherently boring because you think it's going to be good for you. That's what concentrate means. Yeah? Is that what samadhi means? I don't think so. I don't think samadhi, in fact, has anything to do with concentration. And in fact, I think if you were to draw a circle of all the meanings of concentration and a circle of the meanings of samadhi, they'd be like that. That's how far apart they are. Samadhi in India, in both in Buddhist circles and in the Hindu scriptures, means a profound realization of the unification and infinite nature of consciousness. That's what it means when the Buddha talked about samadhi, and that's what it meant in the Upanishads and the Indian usage. What does that have to do with concentration? It has nothing to do with it at all. Right? So once we've decided that we're going to concentrate on something, we've already decided that actually it's kind of boring and we'd rather be doing something else. Yeah? And we need to get away from this notion of trying and concentrating and all of these kinds of things. The teacher of my metta meditation, Ajahn Mahachatchai, this cat here reminds me of it, but he used to say that when you're meditating, if you try to grab your meditation object and sort of try to pull your mind into the meditation object. That's what we do, isn't it? We sort of grab it and pull it in and we try to bring it here. He said it's like trying to grab a cat, right? You sort of grab it by the whiskers and try to pull it towards you. What's the cat going to do? It's going to scream and yowl and scratch your hand. What do you expect? But that's what happens in our meditation. He said if you want the cat to come, you put down a bowl of milk. Yeah? The cat comes up and drinks the milk. Yeah? So this is what we have to do in meditation. We're not trying, we're not concentrating. We put down a bowl of milk. What is that bowl of milk? That bowl of milk is the sukha, the pleasure and the happiness in meditation. Your mind naturally comes and sits down and is peaceful. Yeah? Sukhupanisa samadhi. Sukha is the condition for samadhi. How many times did the Buddha teach this? How many times do we find in the suttas the way to samadhi is through pamoja is joy, pamoja leads to pasadhi is to rapture is bhiti, rapture leads to pasadhi is tranquility, but tranquility leads to sukha is pleasure, sukha leads to samadhi, and samadhi leads to seeing things as they really are. And this is the Buddha talks about this again and again and again and again and again and again and again so many times in the suttas. And yet we think somehow the way to samadhi is to force yourself to sit in a meditation hall all day and be uncomfortable. Where did the Buddha say that? No, he didn't. We think the way to samadhi is to make yourself sit in a posture without moving for hour after hour after hour. Where did the Buddha say that? There's nowhere. He never said that. We think that samadhi means you have to get this meditation technique right and do all the steps right. Where did the Buddha say that? He didn't. Samadhi is conditioned by sukha, it's pleasure. And if we're not able to find that pleasure in our meditation, our mind won't find samadhi. So, how do we find the pleasure? That pleasure is the pleasure of letting go. The Buddha called the nekama sukha, pleasure of renunciation, pleasure of letting go. Okay, so come back to this model of talking about things. Here I am. trying to concentrate on my object. Right? So I've already talked about this idea of an object. I'm trying to concentrate on my breath. My breath is something out there. I'm in here. My breath is out there, and I'm trying to concentrate on it. It's a very weird way of thinking. Okay? But then the next stage, I'm trying to concentrate, and then all these distracting thoughts come and disturb me. Right? So now we have three things. It's getting more and more complicated, right? First it was easy, I was just here, but now I've got all these different things. I've got me in here, I've got my breath out there, and then I've got all these thoughts coming out. Oh, no wonder it's exhausting, right? So what's going on? What are these thoughts that are coming? Are these thoughts that are being beamed to you? Is this like Mara who's coming and making these thoughts appear to you? I do not think so. I suspect that in the majority of cases, these thoughts are things that you are doing. I don't think that Mara is that interested in you. He might have been interested in the Buddha and to come and try to disturb him, but I don't think that you're a big enough target for Mara to worry about. Sorry to say that. The thoughts, again, just like the breath, the thoughts is not something that's outside of you. Thoughts are something that you are doing. Right? The thoughts are your creations. Even this is what the word sankharas means in Pali. Sankharas means your creations, your activities. Right? So why is it that we think of these thoughts as being external to us? Right? We think of the thoughts as being not me. Right? But this is not the not me of anatta, right? Anatta is something different. This is the not me of saying, I don't want to know. I don't want these thoughts to be there, right? Actually, it's a holding on to a me. Again, to come back to this idea, I started with the I. I'm trying to concentrate on my breath and I keep being distracted by these thoughts. We begin with the I. I'm in here, my breath is out there and these thoughts are out there. So all of these nasty thoughts aren't mine, right? I'm pure and good. Right? I'm in here. I'm the meditator. I'm the good one. Ah, I'm here to practice Dhamma. Yeah? Ah, I'm so pure and I'm so good. And oh, that's a thought's a nasty thought, isn't it? That couldn't be mine. That's coming from outside me. Okay, we'll draw a line and say that's out there. Oh, that one's even nastier. Ooh. Oh, that one's quite nice actually, but not nice in a good way. Hang on, we'll put that one aside too. Okay. And so we don't want to own up to these thoughts. Because we have this idea in our mind of ourself as a good person. And we don't want to accept the idea that good people can have bad thoughts. Especially not when it's us. But it's true, of course. We all have greed, hate and delusion. We all have the five hindrances. Anybody who is an arahant in the audience, please forgive me. And you're accepted from this part, okay? But for those of us who are non-arahant, we still have greed, hatred, and delusion. So, these are the sources of the thoughts. These are the forces in the mind that give rise to these thoughts. And what happens when we exclude these things, right? When we say, oh, here I am trying to concentrate on my breath and these thoughts come from outside. We've cut these things off. We said, I'm in here. We can't ever understand greed, hatred, and delusion. We can't ever understand what these hindrances are and what these forces are that are giving rise to the thoughts. And so we're constantly in this mode of trying to suppress the symptoms. All right? We're always going out, trying to push this one thought, I'll be mindful, I'll bring the mind back. And meditation's such hard work. That's why meditation's hard work. Because we're always trying to bring the mind back to this object. We're trying to keep these thoughts out. We're trying again and again and again to bring the meditation object to mind, right? And we've created this very hard job to do in meditation. And underlying it, the purpose of that hard job is to keep the walls around our own self, around our own delusion. Yeah? And then we meditate and we don't get very far, and we get frustrated, and we say, oh, this meditation's no good, oh, it's so hard. And then people come to see me, and they say, oh, Bhante, meditation's so hard. And I say, no, it's not, meditation's easy. And they say, no, it's not, it's so hard. And I say, it's easy, and then they just laugh and go away. But it's true, meditation is easy. You don't have to do anything. And the real meditation happens when you stop doing all of those things. When you realize there's no breath out there which is separate from me, breath is something that I'm doing. Thinking is something that I'm doing. Greed, hatred, and delusion are part of who I am. That's okay. Greed, hatred, and delusion's all right. If we make a big problem out of these things, it's all right. You've lived with greed, hatred, and delusion your whole life, right? You're all right, you're here. Life goes on. Yeah, you get angry sometimes, it's okay. You do something stupid, that's all right, you know. You get over it, right? So don't make too much of a big thing. These things are ordinary. Yeah? It's just ordinary suffering that we all have. So don't be ashamed about it, don't be worried about it, don't be concerned about it. You remember, the most important thing to remember is that in greed, hatred, and delusion, the panchanivarana, however we think about it, these things are compared to us, compared to our ego, our willpower. These things are huge, right? Now, if you've ever tried to use your willpower and your ego to overcome greed, then you know what a losing battle that is, right? I mean, we're in the New Year's period. Everyone makes New Year's resolution. You know, I'm going to stop eating chocolate, or I'm going to cut back on the amount of TV that I watch or something. And how often does it work? Well, never, right? So this is just delusion that thinks you can do that, right? Then it's like we're like an ant and we're looking up at this skyscraper of greed, hatred, and delusion. And it's so big and it's so powerful. We can't imagine any way of overcoming it. And that's why we get tight around these things and it becomes a problem. Right? So if we're trying to overcome greed, hatred, and delusion ourselves, it's hopeless and it will be a struggle. Right? But there's only one thing that is more powerful than the power of the defilements, and that is the power of the Dhamma and the power of wisdom. Yeah. And if we're like an ant and greed, hatred, and delusion is like a mountain, then the Dhamma is like the planet Earth. And if we allow the Dhamma to take its course, then greed, hatred, and delusion will be just swept away as if it was nothing. Not because it's us, right? Not because of anything you do, but because of the power of the Dhamma. So we have a little bit of faith. Okay, here I am breathing. I'm breathing in and breathing out. It's something that I'm doing. Here I am thinking, these thoughts coming up. Oh, okay, hateful thoughts, vengeful thoughts, sexual thoughts, desirous thoughts, loving thoughts, kind thoughts, compassionate thoughts, all mixed up and going around and round and round. That's okay. They're things, everybody has them. We don't worry about it. Just let them go. Don't get caught up in them. And don't go running after the thoughts. These are just the symptoms. We look for the causes. Greed, hatred, and delusion. If the thoughts come up and you want them and you want to keep them, this is your greed. If the thoughts come up and you want to get rid of them, you want to push them away, this is your anger. Right? If the thoughts come up and you think this is something that I can do and I can solve and I can overcome, then this is your delusion. Yeah? So wisdom is, you understand, just let the Dhamma take its course. Be peaceful, let go. And you bring all of these things in. So one of the image or the story that I like to use to try to illustrate this, and I have to apologize because this is a very culturally specific analogy here, okay? And I gave this analogy in Germany a little while ago, and again I had to apologize because it involves going to the beach. And in Germany, going to the beach is not probably a very pleasant experience, even if you can find any beach. But in Australia, the beach is like it's like Tusi to heaven, right? It's like Nirvana, right? So the beach is, for us, is beach is like the most sacred site that you can go on a pilgrimage to, okay? So I don't know what the equivalent would be in Sri Lanka, but you had, anyway, you have to make up your own mind about what you think. Maybe it's going to visit the sacred Bodhi tree in Anuradhapura or something, I don't know. But anyway, I'll just tell you the metaphor as an Australian, and you can translate it into your own situation. Okay, so here's the story. You're at work. Your boss is yelling at you. You've got too much work to do. Your workmates are uncooperative and everything goes wrong. Every time you try to do something, it just doesn't work, and it gets really frustrating. And you had all these things that you were supposed to do in the afternoon, but in fact you made one phone call and you got put on hold and spent the whole afternoon waiting for this phone call to finish this one phone call, and all the other things didn't get done and you're really frustrated. And so you finish your work and you get in your car and you drive home. And on the way home you're thinking, I'm just not ready to go right home just yet. So you take a detour and you go to the beach. And it's a really hot day. I was in Sydney last year. We had one day it was 47 degrees. 47 is like really, really, really hot, yeah? It was a very funny day because everybody was just stumbling around saying, wow, it's really hot. you couldn't do anything else. It's just like really, really hot. Anyway, so you go down to the beach and it's just the sun's just setting. Maybe it's a full moon day. The moonlight's just coming up over the ocean. There's a little bit of a cool breeze coming through. So you just get that kind of relief from the heat of the day. And you park your car and you walk down onto the sand. And there's not many people there. There's a few people walking up and down the beach, but there's not many people around. And you walk along the beach for a little while, and the ocean is very, very gentle. There's no big waves or anything like that. It's just the gentle, little small waves coming in and out. And you walk down the beach for a little while, and then you just sit on the sand. And as you just sit there very quietly, just by yourself, you can just feel all of those worries and stresses of the day just falling away. Yeah, as if the breeze is just blowing them away, and the gentle rhythm of the ocean is just rocking backwards and forwards, and you can feel everything just becoming a bit peaceful and a bit okay. And you sit there for a little while and then you can get up and go. Now, so even if you think about what that's like and what that experience is like, ask yourself, well, why is it that in that kind of situation that you become peaceful? What's actually going on? Now, if you're a meditator, what would probably happen is you go along to the beach, you sit down, and you think, okay, now I have to make myself peaceful by focusing on every wave as it comes in and goes out. And each wave comes in, you're going, one wave coming in, one wave going out, two wave coming in, two wave going out, three wave coming in, three wave going out. Oh no, my mind wanders. How many waves have I thought about? Oh, I've forgotten. Now I have to go back to the beginning and start again now. Okay, one wave coming in, one wave going out, two wave coming in, three wave going out. And your mind's thinking, oh, I have sort of thinking, bring back. That's how a meditator does it. And they're like, ah, oh, I went down to the beach. The beach just wasn't working today. It must have been something broken about it. Yeah. They told me the beach was really peaceful, but nah, I just ended up with a headache. You're not being peaceful because you're doing something, right? Actually, it's just inherently peaceful to be there. And you're peaceful because you can stop doing things. Because you can stop worrying about achieving anything or getting anything or being anybody. Yeah? So just to be in that peaceful environment is what makes you peaceful. Yeah? So this is how we should approach our breath meditation. We're not doing this method or this technique in order to make ourselves peaceful. We're breathing. We're living. When you're sitting there breathing, your breath is keeping you alive. And that is some, and to be aware of that and to do that consciously is inherently peaceful. We allow ourselves to breathe, allow ourselves to be aware of the breath, and the breath will take care of us. Right? And this is the other fallacy of that idea of the breath as an object. Right? If you think of the breath as an object, it's something very clinical. It's kind of out there. The breath isn't anything clinical. The breath is what is keeping you alive. Every moment of your life, from the time when you came out of your mother's womb until the moment you die, the breath is keeping you alive. And you are only a few short breaths away from gasping panic. Right? You know what it's like to be deprived of your breath, even for a few seconds. Yeah? After 10, 20, 30 seconds, you're starting to get a bit worried. After maybe a minute, the panic comes in. Yeah? Shortly later, you're unconscious and then you're dead. Just a few minutes. That thin veil, that thin, like a bubble of protection that we have around our life, that's keeping us from a very horrible death. That's what the breath is doing. Our breath is looking after us every moment of every day. Yeah? So we put ourselves into the hands of our breath. We can trust our breath. It's been looking after us all our life. We trust the breath. It's not going to let us down. So rather than thinking it's my job to pay attention to the breath, we think, get out of the way, let the breath look after us, let the breath take care of us. Let the breath do its job, yeah? Soothing and calming, that soft, gentle rhythm, like the wash of that waves back and forward, gentle rhythm, calming you down and soothing you down. Yeah, so as the Buddha talked about in breath meditation, the pasambhayam kaya sankaram asasisamiti. Yeah, as the bodily activities, the sankaras, the energies of the body become tranquil while I breathe in and out. Yeah, again, not I make myself pay attention to the breath so that I can make my body become tranquil. Right, I'm breathing in and out. And the energies in the body become tranquil. This is that process of breath meditation, and that's why breath meditation is peaceful. We can trust the breath. It's a place of safety and a place of peace. So it's time for us to do some guided meditation together. So what I'll do is I'll lead you in a guided breath meditation, and this guided meditation is mostly for those who maybe don't have much meditation experience. If you've meditated before and you're happy to keep practicing the method that you've been using, that's fine. Just keep doing whatever method that you've been using. So please be clear about what I'm saying here. I'm not saying that you should not do a method or you should change the method that you're doing or anything like that. You keep meditating, do the same meditation you've been doing before, right? But I'm just saying, just change the way you're looking at the meditation a little bit, yeah? So shift around, rather than seeing it in terms of the object out there, we see it in terms of what am I bringing to the meditation, okay? So it's just a slightly different way of looking at it. And when you turn the meditation around, and we look at it from that subjective side, what we're bringing to it, then hopefully what you'll find is that your mind will become peaceful and settle down much more naturally and much more easily. Yeah? So again, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Don't think I'm saying that you should not watch your breath or anything like that. I'm just saying, look at it from the subject. What are you bringing to the meditation? Yeah? And we're bringing that compassion and that kindness and that letting go. We're letting go, letting the breath do the work. Okay? All right, so we'll do some guided meditation for the next 45 minutes or so.